Never was a worry more misplaced than the one which had haunted Elbridge Gerry at the Constitutional Convention. That of a Congress creating a permanent, regular army that would quickly turn into a latter-day Praetorian Guard, threatening the very life of the Republic. For whatever Gerry's anxieties about the power granted to Congress to raise and support armies, and provide and maintain a navy, and make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, the army and navy which Congress actually called into being in the 1790s was so absurdly small as to be unthreatening, not just to the Republic, but to everyone else. The 86 regiments and battalions which had composed the Army of the United States during the Revolutionary War, the Continental Army, technically ceased to exist as of June 3, 1784, when the Army, which had fought the battles of Long Island, Trenton, Brandywine, Germantown, Monmouth, Cowpens, Guilford Courthouse, and Yorktown, was ordered to disband. The only modern U.S. Army unit which can claim direct descent from the Continental Army is the 1st Battalion, 5th Field Artillery Regiment, which in 1784 simply provided the guard for the Confederation's military stores housed at West Point on the Hudson River. George Washington had warned the Confederation Congress that it should not fool itself into thinking that it needed no professional military force, or that it could get by with calling on the states for the use of their militia in an emergency. "I must beg leave to remark," he wrote in September 1783, "that the militia will not afford that prompt and efficacious resistance to an enemy which might be expected from regularly established light infantry companies, or general selection of the ablest men from every regiment or brigade of militia." He hoped that Congress would retain at least 2,631 long-service infantry and artillerymen. That would keep in existence a nucleus of trained professionals, which could then be expanded to include the best of the state militia as needed. But all that the Confederation Congress voted to create was a minuscule military force, all of 700 men, organized into a single regiment of 7 infantry companies and 2 artillery companies, and 37 officers. And like so much else under the Confederation, the states reserved the authority to commission the officers and recruit the troops. Washington sighed. "A large standing army in time of peace has ever been considered dangerous to the liberties of a country, and so only the thought of a few troops would even be tolerated. Fortunately for us," he added, "our relative situation requires but few." Washington could at least console himself with the thought that the army affairs had ended up better than those of the navy. The Continental Navy had to be scraped into being from the purchase of odds and ends of merchant sailing ships, the commission or purchase of a few real warships from the French, and the even more hasty improvisation of a few gunboats into a successful flotilla on Lake Champlain. One of these gunboats, the Philadelphia, was sunk there in 1776, only to be rediscovered on the floor of the lake in 1935, raised and then bequeathed to the Smithsonian in 1961. Otherwise, the Continental Navy's expeditions generally did not end well. A combined land and sea operation against a British base on the coast of Maine in 1779 twisted into a fiasco, with 19 ships lost. 4 of the Navy's precious frigates were captured when the British occupied Charleston in 1780. The Navy's last surviving frigate, the Alliance, was sold off in 1785 for $26,000. For a brief moment, in response to Shays' rebellion, The frightened Confederation Congress sluggishly moved to triple the size of its diminutive army, although the recruitment had to be explained officially as a necessity to deal with Indian troubles, lest even this modest increase generate suspicion from anxious state legislatures about an overmighty central government. But the states did little to recruit the new force, and after Governor Bowdoin's little mercenary army and the Massachusetts state militia put down Shays' rebellion, Congress happily went back to the same comfortable policies it had been following and disbanded its newly recruited soldiers. Perhaps Congress imagined it could get by with the services of just the state militias. This was not going to be true of the Navy, since the states did not maintain navies as they did militia. And as soon as the Treaty of Paris made it clear that American merchant shipping was no longer protected by the mantle of the Royal Navy, pirates from the coasts of North Africa began feasting on hapless American merchantmen in the Mediterranean, starting in July 1785 with the capture of the American merchant ships Maria and Dauphin. These Barbary pirates were really the naval flotillas of the various small Muslim principalities of Algiers, Tunis, and Libya. And they not only raided American ships, but held their crews as slaves until ransomed. But even the state militias might not be equal to more domestic troubles even on land. On the northern and northwestern frontier, the powerful Indian tribes of the Iroquois Federation, the Six Nations of the Mohawks, Oneidas, Onondagas, Cayugas, Senecas, and Tuscaroras, as well as their western dependents, the Shawnee, Wyandot, Chippewa, and Delaware, were willing to concede that their allies, the British, had been defeated in the Revolutionary War, but they were much less willing to admit that they had been defeated. "We have been hitherto bound by the great king," insisted the Mohawk sachem, Aaron Hill. "But he, having broke the chain and left us to ourselves, we are again free and independent." So when American commissioners and Iroquois chiefs met at Fort Stanwix in the fall of 1784 to create a peace settlement, the Iroquois balked at being treated as a conquered people who had lost title to their territories along the Great Lakes. It did no good. The entire Indian population east of the Mississippi amounted to little more than 160,000 people. And in the end, the Seneca sachem, corn planter, bargained away land in New York and Ohio in order to get peace and secure title to what was left. Similar treaties with the Iroquois Western allies followed in 1785 at Fort McIntosh and in 1786 at Fort Finney, while to the south, the Cherokees and Creeks made similar bargains in the treaties at Augusta and at Hopewell. But the bargains angered dissidents among the tribes. Joseph Brant among the Iroquois, Alexander McGillivray among the Creeks, Dragging Canoe among the Cherokee, who eyed these agreements with suspicion. In 1785, low-level warfare broke out in the Ohio country and Kentucky, as Shawnee and Cherokee war parties pushed back on encroaching white settlements. And when the Confederation proved unable to respond, the extended North Carolina settlements, which are today the state of Tennessee, made disturbing motions toward proclaiming themselves the state of Franklin and began conducting backdoor negotiations with the Spanish, with Don Diego de Gardoqui, in order to put themselves under the sovereignty and protection of Spain. In spite of this, Americans remained entranced by the reputation of citizen soldier militias, like the ones they thought had won the Revolution, and the over-glorified remembrance of how the militia at Lexington and Concord gave them ball for ball, from behind each fence and farmyard wall, chasing the redcoats down the lane, then crossing the fields to emerge again under the trees at the turn of the road, and only pausing to fire and load. When Washington's officers attempted to form a veterans association in the post-war years, the Society of the Cincinnati, Benjamin Franklin snorted that this would lead to establishing ranks of nobility. And the ever-watchful Elbridge Gerry accused the society, during the Constitutional Convention, of a conspiracy to elect the chief magistrate in every instance. So even though in 1787 the Philadelphia Convention overrode Gerry's paranoia and authorized Congress to raise and support armies and provide and maintain a navy, what Congress actually raised and supported was not much of an improvement on the Confederation's version of an army and navy. A Department of War was created on August 7, 1789, and Washington's old artillery chief, Henry Knox, was appointed to head it, as he had done for the Confederation's War Department. But when Knox introduced Washington's plan for a legionary corps of 2,000 men whose cadres would absorb the state militias in times of emergency, the new Congress stiffened. When Congress finally approved a plan on September 29, 1789, it provided only for a single regular regiment of 840 men in 8 infantry companies and 4 artillery companies. A year later, Congress grudgingly authorized a modest expansion to 1,200 men in 12 companies. But they might have saved themselves even that small trouble. In 1790, 3 companies of this first regiment, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Josiah Harmer, along with 1,500 Pennsylvania and Virginia militia, attempted to track down marauding Shawnee and Miami Indians along the Maumee River in western Ohio. The Indians instead turned on Harmer's force, sending the militia fleeing in panic and allowing the regulars to stand and be massacred. Congress was galvanized into authorizing a second regiment of regulars. But when the governor of the Northwest Territory, Arthur St. Clair, tried to lead them in a second expedition, St. Clair blundered into an Indian ambush at the headwaters of the Wabash River, and they were nearly annihilated. Finally, in March of 1792, Congress voted to reconstitute the 2 existing infantry regiments and recruit 3 further infantry regiments and 4 troops of mounted infantry, or dragoons. Armed with the independent financial powers given by the Constitution, Congress did not have to go cap in hand to the states for the money for these troops. In fact, Congress passed a national militia bill in May of 1792, which spelled out the federal government's authority over the state militias in explicit terms. With those resources finally in force, Revolutionary veteran Anthony Wayne brought the Shawnee and Miami to bay at the Battle of Fallen Timbers on August 20, 1794, and ended at least that threat for the moment. This did nothing, however, to deal with the Barbary pirates. It was not until March of 1794 that Congress passed a naval act that funded the construction of 6 new frigates, 4 of them oversized 44-gun warships designed to render them superior to any frigate belonging to the European powers, and 2 conventional 36-gun frigates. But when a treaty was signed in 1795 with the Algerians, work on 3 of the ships was suspended. It took the outbreak of the quasi-war with France under President Adams before Congress would take its obligations to raise and support armies and provide and maintain a navy with real seriousness. And it would take Adams's Secretary of War, James McHenry, to put them into play for the first time. McHenry was Irish-born, but immigrated to America in 1771 and became a physician. He served as a military surgeon in the Revolution and, after the war, left medicine to go into business and into politics as a member of the Maryland legislature. He was part of the Maryland delegation to the Constitutional Convention, although his work in the convention was minimal. He was absent for 2 months, dealing with a brother who lay dangerously sick in Baltimore. But he agreed to give the new Constitution all the support in my power and steered the Maryland State Ratifying Convention toward ratification. He became part of Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Circle, and Hamilton actually recommended McHenry to Washington after the disgrace of Edmund Randolph as a likely Secretary of State in 1796. But George Washington posted McHenry instead to the War Department. And when John Adams succeeded Washington in the presidency a few months later, Adams kept McHenry in place. A sketch done in the 1790s by James Sharpless of Philadelphia shows a bland and somewhat sleepy-eyed gentleman, very respectable in the candid estimate of William Pierce, but a man of specious talents with nothing of genius to improve them. Still, they also serve who only stand and wait, and in McHenry's case, he had waited for the right time. He was warned at the outset that Congress wanted a prudent, firm, frugal officer who in private life knows the value of money, which McHenry did. But he also knew the folly of being penny wise and dollar foolish. And he at once announced that his priorities would be to create a navy and always maintain a formidable army. This, for McHenry, meant an army of not less than 12,000 regulars and a navy with at least 12, not just frigates, but line-of-battle ships. He had the encouragement of the Federalist Old Guard, especially Fisher Ames in the House of Representatives, but his most unlooked-for friend was actually the French Republic. For once the news of the XYZ affair broke, covering the United States with diplomatic humiliation from the French Revolutionary Directory, Congress was ready to give McHenry and Adams anything they wanted. A new, additional army of 12 infantry regiments and 6 troops of light dragoons, plus the completion of the 3 unfinished frigates, President, Chesapeake, and Congress. In addition, Congress authorized the construction of 6 74-gun ships of the line and a corps of Marines to serve with them. McHenry did not consider himself a Navy man, and at his prompting, Congress authorized the creation of an entirely separate Navy department under McHenry's fellow Maryland Federalist, Benjamin Stoddard. McHenry's attention was devoted to recruiting the new additional army, and at its head, he wanted no one less than the retired 66-year-old former president, George Washington. The crisis and almost universal wish of the people to see you at the head of the armies of the United States has been too strong to be resisted, McHenry wrote to Washington on July 3, 1798. You are again called upon by all voices to fill a station which all think you alone qualified for at this moment. Surprisingly, Washington agreed, but with a provision that made President Adams choke, that Alexander Hamilton would be appointed as his second in command. Adams had not forgiven Hamilton's chilliness in supporting Adams's difficult campaign for the presidency against Thomas Jefferson in 1796. Hamilton, in Adams' estimate, was a proud, spirited, conceited, aspiring mortal, always pretending to morality, but possessing as debauched morals as old Franklin, and was as great an hypocrite as any in the United States. As much as Adams wanted Washington in command in order to fend off Republican critics who would accuse him of creating the Provisional Army for a coup against Congress, he was certain that Hamilton wanted to use this provisional additional army to undermine his own presidential authority. But Adams really had no choice. He signed a commission for Washington as Lieutenant General. Hamilton would join him as the Army's Inspector General with the rank of Major General. Adams was right about Hamilton's ambitions. And in fact, Hamilton started by bestowing unwanted advice on McHenry about the reorganization of the War Department staff. My friend McHenry is wholly insufficient for his place, with the additional misfortune of not having the least suspicion of the fact, Hamilton breezily informed Washington. It is so great as to leave no probability that the business of the War Department can make any tolerable progress in his hands. One-upping even McHenry, Hamilton now proposed to Congress the recruitment of a further 24 regiments of infantry, battalions of riflemen, artillerists, and engineers, and 3 regiments of cavalry. But while Hamilton was lighting a fire in McHenry's front, President Adams was lighting another at his rear, pressuring McHenry to get Washington to change his mind about designating Hamilton as his second in command. And when Washington refused, Adams blamed McHenry for conspiring against him. And yet, for all the backstabbing and backstairs maneuvering, McHenry launched recruiting for the additional army, along with a revived military staff. New fortifications were to be built, including one in Baltimore Harbor that would bear McHenry's name. New uniform styles were adopted, and a new weapons manufacturing arsenal began at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, on a Potomac River site which Washington, ever with the eye to the main chance of developing the Potomac River Highway, had recommended. What no one among the Federalists seemed to have stopped to ask themselves was actually a very obvious question. Why? Why are we doing all this? And what is it going to look like? McHenry was sincerely convinced, as he explained to Adams, that France aims at universal dominion, that the vices of her government and nature of her system render war indispensable to her, and that she really intends, at a fit moment, to bring the United States, or a part of them, by her arms, added to her intrigues, into the same state of vassalage. It was only left, in McHenry's thinking, for Adams to recommend to Congress an immediate declaration of war against that nation. But did anyone seriously believe that the French Republic's army was poised to overleap 3,000 miles of ocean in order to conquer its American counterpart? Even Washington half-heartedly admitted that, disregardful as the French are of treaties and of the law of nations, and capable as I conceive them to be of any species of despotism and injustice, it really seemed difficult to believe that they will attempt to invade this country after such a uniform and unequivocal expression of the sense of the people in all parts to oppose them with their lives and fortunes. Unlike McHenry, President Adams placed all of his expectations on what the Navy would do in warding off French marauders on the high seas and in the Caribbean. And they did that surprisingly well. So what then was the purpose of the new United States Army? McHenry unwittingly fed Republican paranoia by asserting that the additional army was needed because it is a maxim in France's policy to prepare the country she designs to subdue by previous divisions among its citizens before she strikes it. Which was as much as saying that the additional army's first target would be seditionists within the American Republic, and only then French invaders. And as if to confirm the bleak suspicions of the Jeffersonian Republicans, the first employment McHenry had for his new recruits was the suppression of a minor uprising against the taxes levied for the new army in eastern Pennsylvania under an auctioneer named John Freese. The worst nightmare of Elbridge Gerry a decade before would seem to have come to pass. McHenry was aghast when, far from declaring war, Adams announced in February 1799 that he was sending William Vans Murray to France to reopen the negotiations that the XYZ affair had closed down. When Murray's mission produced an agreement with the French, Congress cheerfully slashed funding for McHenry's army. Congress, McHenry sighed, yielded to the supposed momentum of public opinion and stopped enlistments. The Navy is to engulf everything. Despite the importance of both the military and naval establishments. But some, however, wrote McHenry, think one of them sufficient, and that to undo the one is to secure funds for the other. Congress, however, only deprived McHenry of funding. President Adams deprived him of a job. In May 1800, the New York State legislative elections went against the Federalists. And Adams interpreted this as a devious plot by Hamilton to undercut Adams' upcoming battle for re-election against Thomas Jefferson. On May 5th, Adams summoned McHenry for a meeting of 1 minute, which in fact turned into a maniacal tirade, accusing McHenry of complicity with Hamilton in indecorous and at times outrageous language. McHenry resigned as Secretary of War the next day. McHenry did not nurse Adams' outburst quietly, but he was more concerned with what was likely to happen to the army he had done so much to call into being. "It was my constant endeavor to conduct the business of the War Department with economy and to render its important expenditures of permanent utility to the United States," McHenry wrote later in 1800, still steaming. But his real anger was directed toward the fantasy that a professional army is the enemy of a republic, and the militia its only true salvation, and that the first can always be created whole cloth in a crisis as soon as the second has demonstrated its imbecility. "I dislike the system of expediency, or providing for every public want and necessity as they originated. I labored, therefore, incessantly to introduce everywhere a different system, and to lay, at a small expense, certain military foundations capable of producing, in seasons which must occur to all nations, the most decisive effects." When McHenry looked back, "I lament only," he said, "that I did not leave the office when General Washington retired from the presidency." In this case, McHenry was actually shortchanging himself. The additional army had only recruited 3,400 men by the time it was ordered to disband by Congress in June 1800. But not even Thomas Jefferson, as the new president, could contemplate turning the clock entirely back to the days before McHenry's secretaryship. So the army would remain set at 4 regiments of infantry, 2 of artillery and engineers, and 2 companies of light dragoons, along with its general staff. Not any huge force, but not the pitiful business James McHenry had begun with. McHenry's plan for a military academy was actually taken up by Jefferson in 1802. Using the garrison facilities at West Point. There have been many nominees for the title of father of the United States Army. But among the founders, James McHenry may well have the best claim of all.